Welcome to Two Dope Boys in a Podcast. I'm Phil McKenzie.
I'm Michael Brooks.
On Point is where we highlight someone getting it right. And I'm really excited to have in the studio with us a man that I'm going to sort of make his introduction very brief, because we're going to talk a lot about his history and his role, pivotal role in New York culture, music culture, hip-hop culture, art culture. So we're joined today by Michael Holman, hip-hop historian and hip-hop pioneer. I tried to sum it up, but welcome. How you doing?
Good. Thank you for having me, Two Dope Boys.
Thank you for being here, dope scholar.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm into it.
So, you know, let's just jump right
into
it.
I like dope things, man. So,
well, let's start with New York.
Okay.
New York.
I love New York.
Is it still dope?
Yeah.
Always.
Okay. All right. See?
Hasn't gone post-dope.
I'm sometimes a little cynical on whether or not New York is still dope or not, but what got you to New York?
Well, just on the point of, is New York still dope?
Yeah.
It's worth a minute.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
No doubt.
Take two.
I mean, this is something that people like myself, who are, you know, pioneers and veterans of, you know, the early 80s, late 70s New York scene, whether it be uptown or downtown or somewhere in between, we, you know, lament those days. We know that for example, the East Village was made up of, you know, maybe 400 hip kids, you know, and you only knew maybe 150 of them, and that was our whole community. And it was somewhere between, you know, Club 57, you know, where Keith Haring and Kenny Scharf and, you know, Ann Magnuson ruled, or the Mud Club, where, you know, Jean-Michel Basquiat and John Laurie and that whole scene ruled. And, you know, that was it. And our world was very small, and all we really wanted to do was impress our friends. And today there's like tens of thousands of, you know, students and kids coming to New York to try to basically, you know, wear the shine that we left behind, you know, without really paying their dues, unfortunately. And so the veterans who stayed, who were still alive, who didn't run away, you know, we look around New York. Yeah, it's much different. But, and as an armchair anthropologist and as an armchair geologist almost, and paleoanthologicalist.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm an armchair know what the fuck any of those things meanest.
Yeah. But, you know, there is something absolutely vital about the city of New York.
Yes.
That transcends even the population at any one given time. I mean, you would think, and the cliche is, you know, a city is made by the people who live there. And that makes a lot of sense, especially for a city like New York. That's such, you know, creative, vibrant people. Some of them are buck wild criminals, and others are like, you know, but there's something special about the people who are here. But nevertheless, there is, I don't know if it's a quartz vein that runs through the island of Manhattan, you know, that's 50 miles long and a mile in diameter. I don't know if it's like an alien landing spot, but there is something special about the city, about the geography, about the history, about the climate, about the people that are attracted here for whatever reasons. There's something special about New York that can withstand even the most tired crowd that comes here wanting to be down and who really aren't down. It can survive all of that and still be a badass place where you want to be, and you can find something special here, do something special here, change the world, make a name for yourself. It'll always have that vibrancy and that power. And what gives it that, I'm really not sure. Maybe it's the proximity to the ocean and to you know, and to commerce and that sort of, you know, travel and you know, and most port cities have some kind of importance.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the fact that it's an island. Maybe it has something to do with the longitude or the latitude. But there is absolutely something spectacularly fabulous and interesting and important about New York, and I don't know exactly what it is, but I could never leave this city. As a matter of fact, my band Grey, I started with Jean-Michel Basquiat, one of the remaining members, myself and Nick Taylor. We wrote a song called "Never Gonna Leave New York City."
You know, I love New York, But I have like a love-hate relationship with New York. It's especially now.
Well, everyone does.
Like, and I always come back to like New York Magazine. They had like one of their like their New York issue of New York Magazine, and they asked for readers to like send in a quote or something that in their mind described what it was like to live and be in New York. And some person wrote in that, you know, New York is like an abusive boyfriend, or, you know, I think they use boyfriend, so it was very gender specific, but I guess you can substitute any anything you want.
Abusive girlfriend.
Yeah, it's an abusive insert.
How's
your,
that going, Matt? Yeah. You all right with that? His
girlfriend a little abusive. I think it's much more of a feminine power, basically.
Yeah.
But go ahead, go ahead.
It's an abusive boyfriend that just when you're about to leave does something truly amazing, and then you're committed for another 6 months to a year.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And I thought like that does a really good, accurate description of New York. I gotta admit, I'm not as hopeful on New York as you are. And it pains me to say that because I was born here.
Well, you were
here.
Born and raised here.
Born so and raised here.
I mean, of course you're going to be interested in, you know, exploring other places and, you know, but I wasn't born and raised here.
Where
you know,
were you born and raised?
Well, I was born in San Francisco. My father, I was born into an American Army family. My father's an Army officer. Very soon after being born, we were off to France to live and back to the States and back to Europe for many years. I grew up, a lot of my childhood was in Germany and France. But then a lot of my middle school and high school years and then college was in California, both Southern and Northern California. So, I suppose in the United States, California is really my, you know, my where I'm from.
Right, right, right.
And Bay Area specifically.
And that was interesting, though. You think it's more, New York is more like it's a feminine energy, you were going to say? So like what, were you someone who always knew? Like for me, it was different. It's less dramatic. But like my family was in New York when I was like, you know, a toddler. Like I don't have any memory of them being in Brooklyn when I was that age, but they were there. My family was all around Manhattan and Long Island and whatever. And then my parents fled up to like rural Massachusetts to be hippies. And I remember my first memory of New York when I was probably like, I don't know, 7 or 8 or something was, and it was like Penn Station. It was terrible. It was the worst, but I got out of Penn Station and I just like, was like, oh my God, there's so much going on. I can't believe we left this place. It's so fucking boring where we live. And I knew from that moment that I was going to be back here at some point. I actually basically never doubted that. So did you have did you always know you were New York bound? Like what got you here?
I can remember, there's a couple of moments that stand out in my mind, in my memory. I can remember coming back from Germany, coming back to the United States by ocean liner. We land in New York, and we had to, my father was very practical, so we, you know, like within a couple of days, we had our car packed up as soon as it came off the boat and started heading west. But I remember, as we were driving through Manhattan, we must have been on 57th Street heading west, and I had this moment to look up 7th Avenue towards Central Park. Mm-hmm. You know the view I'm talking about? And it could have been like 5 or 6 in the morning on a summer morning, and the sun was just coming up. And I remember seeing this man wearing riding boots and a jodhpur pants and a sweater tied over his shoulder, very European, whatever, in like 5 or 6 in the morning. And I thought, who is this guy? And what kind of city supports this sort of fashion at this time in the morning? And I thought, man, this place is cosmopolitan. This place is sophisticated. This place is interesting. And then I can remember much later being in the tubes. I don't know if you guys know who the tubes are from California, San Francisco. You know the tubes, 1970s?
No.
Okay, white punks on dope. You never heard of the tubes?
Nah, man.
You got to get hip to the tubes. The tubes were an amazing group out of San Francisco. They were one of the first theatrical rock bands that every song had like staging and props and dancers. And it was really amazing. It was a lot like what Iggy Stardust or you know, Alice Cooper or whatever. But I was in that band, and we, you know, came to New York and performed here. And I can remember being here with them, and you know, because the Tubes were really connected, knowing Stephen Burrows and Pat Cleveland and Beth Ann Hardison and all these people who were in fashion in New York in the 70s, and them taking me out to like Les Jardins and the Blue Angel and the Hollywood and Barney Googles and, I mean, all these like dope disco clubs when disco was, you know, even though I'm a hip hop pioneer, and like, you know, people think of me, most people who know me think of me in association with hip hop. Really, my time was disco. When I was like 20 and 21, it was all about disco. And New York was all about it. And I got to see New York at that moment in time. It was so special. And I knew, even though I was just visiting from California, I knew, okay, this is the only place for me. And I remember specifically in 74 going to the Bethesda Fountain, which is a fountain off 72nd Street and Fifth Avenue. Part of the park, you know, the big fountain. Yeah. It's got the, you know, big eagle or whatever. You can see all the buildings on the west side and east side. Well, what a lot of people don't know is in the mid 70s, that was like on Sunday afternoons, kids from all over the city, but from Brooklyn, from the Bronx, from Manhattan, would show up with boom boxes. And you could show up in the middle of the day, there'd be 50 or 60 boom boxes all lined up on the hills, all tuned to like BLS. Yeah. And on the cobblestone pavement around the fountain, there would be like hundreds of kids dancing, you know, doing the Latin hustle to who's the DJ from BLS who's so, we all know. So Frankie Crocker would be playing like, you know, all these like disco classics, you know, MFSB's Love is the Message or the Tramps or, you know, Bohannon or whatever it was. And kids would be wearing, you know, this whole thrift shop gear look. It was American glam. Like when England was doing their glam thing at the height of David Bowie, and it was all about, you know, like these wild alien look. In America, our equivalent glam look was thrift shop fashion, very much in the keepings of Cap Calloway zoot suits, that whole look. And you'd buy those zoot suits, you'd go to the thrift shops, you'd get all this stuff. And then those days you could actually really buy that original, those original clothes. And New York was the capital of that. And you'd see all these kids wearing girls wearing 1940s summer dresses, you know, eyebrows that were like plucked into these like crazy Betty Boop shape, you know, lines on their foreheads, 1940s hairdos. Everybody had platform shoes. Guys would have these fedoras, big wide, you know, like Desi Arnaz shoulder padded jackets, you know, and guys would have like pajama tight pajama tops with big pleated baggy pants with tight bottoms, you know, at the ankles and marshmallow shoes, which is like, you know, that they look like, yeah, like nurse shoes with big white soles, crepe soles, doing these dances in what was basically the bus stop, what we now know as the Electric Glide, right? Mm. Well, back in the 70s, that's when that dance, well, I shouldn't say the dance started then, because they were doing that kind of formation dances even in the 50s. But anyway, it was new in the 70s. No one had done it in like 20 years. And it started really in New York, and then in L.A. it was called the L.A. Hustle. And kids are doing the bus stop, and there'd be guys on the outside of the formations when the formation would stop. And they would do these freestyle moves, drops, and all kinds of things that really were the precursors to b-boying and breakdancing. And I'm watching all this as this kid from California, from San Francisco, which is, I mean, essentially a provincial outpost, you know, of New York. And I'm watching this. I'm looking at the fashion. I'm looking at the style. I'm looking at the attitude. I'm looking at the makeup on the girls. I'm looking at, like, the music coming from all these radios. And just, I'm thinking to myself, this is a city that's like a theme park, and it doesn't know it. It's a theme park for, like, hip people. Can you curse on this show?
Yeah.
Fuck no.
A theme park for hip motherfuckers. Like everything about it, especially when you come from California and it's so different.
I love all the California hating on this show. Right
it's
now.
It's like it's
especially when you come from that sun drenched place. It's just slow and kind of weak, kind of boring.
Yeah. Anyway,
he said, "Yeah." But how does but when so what so what's the what gets you into that hip hop world? What gets you yeah. kind of connected to how I guess people do know you?
Because it sounds like you're a musician as well. Like you played music in bands. You yeah. mentioned the kind of being in this disco moment, and you know I think Michael hit it. Like, how do you make that transition into the burgeoning scene of hip hop?
Well, you know everything is really weird in that. There's nothing ever stops. Nothing in life really starts from some ground zero. There's always some precursor that gets you where you are. You know, there's always, if I can put it in a nutshell, I was in a band with Jean-Michel Basquiat. You know, we started.
How did you meet him?
Okay, well, you can't ask me like 18 questions. I can only answer one at a time.
Well, just to digress though, seriously, how did you meet the dude?
Okay, well, I was working in Wall Street. When I first came to New York, graduated from the University of San Francisco with an economics degree, and just through connections, I got this job at Chemical Bank on Wall Street. I was in this pre-corporate banker program, you know, with a bunch of other kids from Brown and Yale and all this. I didn't fit in at all, and I'm like hanging out with friends that I knew from California, and we're like doing these like art shows and art. So I'm keeping my hand in the arts, you know. And so we decided to put on and I met Fat Five Freddy through a little blurb in the Village Voice, and he starts coming over, hanging out with myself and this English artist named Stan Peskett, who's a good friend of mine. And we decided, let's throw a party. And the whole idea of the party was to introduce the Fabulous Five, which was a graffiti collective made up of really important, well, one of the most important names, graffiti, Lee Quiñones, Fat Five Freddy, of course, a guy named Doc, Mono, Slave. Anyway, they were like a graffiti collective, and we thought, let's throw a party that brings the this new scene, this thing that we considered, it was either from uptown or from Brooklyn or whatever. It wasn't from downtown New York. Let's get these artists. We weren't thinking hip hop yet. I wasn't anyway. Let's bring these artists and have them rub shoulders with the downtown fine art scene. And so we did. We threw this party. It was April 29th, 1979. And I was like the host and videographer at the time. Freddie with the Fab Five were doing all these pieces, et cetera, et cetera. And this kid, this young guy, I must have been 24 by this point or 23. And this 19-year-old kid shows up. And he's like, you know, I want to be down. And he was so persuasive and so charming and so confident and so unlike most other people you know. You just knew you were in the presence of, like, a realized being. And we were like, yeah, sure, whatever. We put up a big piece of, you know, photo paper, and he had a spray can of red paint, and he starts to write out, you know, which of the following are omnipresent? A, Lee Harvey Oswald. B, Coca-Cola logo. C, General Mallory, who's the guy who ordered the bombing of Hiroshima. And D, Samo copyright. It's like, oh my God, you're Samo. And this was like Jean-Michel Basquiat. And I'm interviewing him, and I'm doing this bugged out thing because I was this goofy kid from California. I was asking people questions, putting the mic in their face, and then taking it away before they could answer and ask another question, put the mic in their face. And when he realized I wouldn't let him speak, he gave me this look that other FOBs have said, yeah, he did that to me too, friends of Basquiat. He just, his face just went like drained of all emotion and all judgment and all, you know, he just went like a stone. And I was looking at myself, I found myself looking in a mirror, watching myself acting the fool, you know, and I started stammering, and the interview was mercifully ended quickly. And 5 minutes later, I went up to him and said, hey man, you know, sorry about that. I was just goofing around. He said, no, you want to start a band? And I was like, yeah. And
so
that evening was the beginning of what, you know, we eventually called, you know, it wasn't called Gray right away, but that was the beginning of Gray. So that's how I met Jean.
Yeah.
So Gray's going along since from 79 through 80, all of 80, and into 81. And then the band breaks up. We have our last gig at the Mud Club, which is like a fascinating story in itself. But And at the end of that gig, Jean pulled me aside after a couple of hours of dancing and whatever. We're all having a great time. And he tells me that he has to leave the band. And this is because he had just had been featured at the PS1 New York New Wave show. And he was the star of the show. He blew up. And he's probably still 19, maybe 20. And his future as an important painter, artist was set. And so he realized, I'm not going to be in a band. I mean, I've got to focus. Mm-hmm. And he quit the band. And I was already a filmmaker and doing things with the band, you know, presenting my films and stuff as kind of like backdrop and whatever, partly based on my experience with that band, the Tubes. And so I just wanted to do more things with film. And I was doing all kinds of wild, like a couple of important films that I made in those days, like Vincent Gallo's Flying Christ. These are all very in-camera, arty, Super 8, like Kenneth Anger, Stan Brakhage, very like avant-garde filmmaking. And then I heard about these kids who spin on their heads, these breakdancers. And I was like, what the hell is that? That's just something else for me to film in New York. That sounds wild. And my pursuing these dancers that do these crazy dances, just so I could film it to add to my film archive, or film ideas, was how I sort of accidentally stumbled into hip hop culture. So that's why I was saying there's no like ground zero. There was something going on that got me into B-boying and that got me into the culture itself.
It's crazy. Like those kind of transitions, I think are always, like when you hear them from a historical perspective, it makes sense. But when you're living in the moment, I'm sure it's different. Like, did you have a path that you saw all of this going, or was it just moving as things inspired you and moved you, and as you met other people?
Well, I think there's two answers. I mean, and they're sort of diametrically opposed, I think. But one answer is that, you know, we were all just very much in the moment, and it was this exciting thing that we knew, like a handful of us knew, like Freddie, for example, and Charlie Ahern and people like that, you know, Henry Chalfant, you know, there was a handful of us that knew what was going on uptown. And we wanted to bring it downtown just to like say, yo, check this out. You know, you think you know something, like check this out. And maybe I'll make some money because, you know, I'll put on an event and charge people at the door or whatever. But for the most part, it was just, I want to share this thing that I've been learning about, that I've been seeing, with the rest of my downtown compatriots, because I know that they don't know anything about it. And it was just fun and it was exciting. There's that, but then there's this other side too that I think at moments I was aware of the fact that this could be something really big, that this could be a new movement. Yeah. In culture, and that not only do I want to turn my downtown friends on to this, but I want to turn the city onto it. I want to turn the country onto it. I want to turn the world onto this. So those two things are playing at the same time, but the bigger thing that's going on in the moment is simply surviving in New York and like dealing with the fact that you haven't paid the rent, and dealing with the fact that you might be hungry, dealing with the fact that, you know, you've got to get from one place to the other. You've got a million chores you have to do that have nothing to do with any of these things, as we all do today. And that takes up most of your time. So the amount of philosophical, you know, armchair observations you're making at the time is very limited and very rare. I mean, for the most part, you're just simply thinking back then about surviving, even though surviving was a lot easier than it is now.
So what did it look like, though, when you started to play that role and, you know, bridge the culture out? And I guess the second part, I am going to ask you a two-part question.
Okay.
Do you think that's your role a lot, that you... Because, you know, now that there's these terms that are very kind of trendy now, like people are translators and people build bridges and all this, but each theme you're talking about, it sounds to me like you got here through like a California story that came to New York. You wanted to connect uptown with downtown, and then you saw this hip hop movement, and it wasn't just that you wanted to experience it, but then you were like, oh, I need to be the link between this and the rest of the city and potentially the rest of the globe. So is that like another theme for you?
Yeah, well, you know, I was all those things, but I'm not sure how conscious I was
totally
of it. I mean,
That's probably why you're so good at it.
Yeah, exactly. That's true. Yeah. If I was like thinking about it and conscious of it and trying to do it, I don't think I would have been as good at it.
Right.
I can remember, okay, as I told you about that Canal Zone party, April 29th, 1979. 2 years later, in 81, after Gray's broken up and blah, 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 those Canal Zone parties were continuing. My friend Stan Peskett, it was his loft, he kept the parties kind of going, you know, maybe once, twice a year, whatever. So in 81, he's having another Canal Zone party in the summer. And this time, Malcolm McLaren is there. Now, from April 79 to the summer of 81, a lot had happened. Started Gray. Gray had its year and a half, and then Gray ended. I'm a downtown filmmaker, as I said. Now, by this point in the summer of 81, I'm already introduced to Bambada. I'm informally managing Rocksteady Crew. I'm the film, hip-hop film guy. I mean, that is me. You know, nobody else is really doing it. Other people are shooting home movies of hip-hop things that you'll see as B-roll in a lot of documentaries these days. But I was actually making finished films about hip-hop. The first hip-hop film is one of my short films, Catch a Beat. And I'm bringing artists downtown. Those kids that I first saw spinning on their heads, I'm getting them gigs to open up for the Tubes when they came to New York to perform. Little things like that are going on, and I'm like moving and shaking, and like I said, bringing this thing downtown and exposing it while everyone's still going like, huh, what? I don't see what is this? I don't get it. So I'm at a party in the summer of 81 at the Canal Zone. And my English friend, Stan Peskett's his loft, like I said, and one of his compatriots from back and much further back, Malcolm McLaren, is at the party. And my friend Stan is telling Malcolm McLaren, you should meet my friend Michael Holman. He's involved in this thing. We didn't call it hip-hop back then. Even as late as summer of 81, it was not called hip-hop. It was not called hip-hop. It was called a lot of things, boyoyoing, park jam, jam culture. It was often called executive style. It was called a lot of weird things. Yeah, executive
That's
style.
That's my favorite one.
Disco, there's a lot of things. And it was never really any one thing. So anyway, I was introduced to Malcolm, and I knew, back to your point, Michael, when I met Malcolm, I knew that if I could have him, if I could somehow rope him into this, if I could introduce him to this thing that's going on in New York, deep, deep underground, I knew, I was confident it would change everything. How I knew that, well, for one easy guess is that Malcolm McLaren is so hungry for new movements, to expose new movements, to be part of new movements culturally. I mean, he's the one who brought, you know, a lot of people credit him for punk in England, and I think he should get that credit. A lot of people don't realize that he simply brought punk bands from New York and brought them to England, and they turned London on to punk. Punk started in New York. I don't know if you know that. Do you know that?
No.
Listen, punk started. Have you ever heard of the Ramones?
Of course, yeah.
Heard of the New York Dolls?
Of course.
You've heard of Television?
Yeah.
Richard Hell and the Voidoids? All these bands existed before it ever happened in London, in England. There was no punk in England. Malcolm McLaren brought those bands, specifically the ones I just mentioned, and brought them to perform in London when they saw what that was about. They took that, the ignorant style of music, the raw style, the speed, the lack of musicianship. Yeah. They added their particular fashion. But the whole thing about safety pins and all that,
right,
that was the Ramones. Their guy who kept their uniforms together would keep them together with safety pins. So they saw this. The English are such biters. They're the biggest. they're the biggest fronters and biters. I mean, they're genius at everything they do, but they have the luxury of biting first, and then, you know, they steal it and then they present it and package it themselves in their own way. And if you tell an English person of a certain age, like anybody who would be like from their 50s to 60s, that punk started in New York, they become apoplectic. I mean, they can't take it. They're like, blah, 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 blah. I mean, they flip out. I've had friends of mine flip out. I mean, I'm going like, dude, calm down, man. All right, all right. But you know, everyone knows the Ramones and beyond that, I mean, punk was even around before it was in New York. I mean, Iggy Pop and the Stooges in Detroit was doing, and then before that, you had Love, Arthur Lee and Love was doing like music that is legitimately punk in 66. Anyway, that's a whole other story. So I meet Malcolm McLaren. I know his history as a cultural mover and shaker. And I have this gut feeling that if I turn him on to this new movement, which was going to be called hip hop any day now,
executive style,
that it would do something. Something would happen,
right.
And of course it would, because you know that's what Malcolm is known for. So you know he's game. I take him up to the Bronx like that weekend. A couple of days later, to a Bambada throwdown, Park Jam up in the Bronx River Community Center, outside of the Bronx River Community Center, warm summer night. And it's wild. It's like Dante's Inferno on acid. I mean, there's like about 1,000 middle school boys, mostly 75% black, 20% Puerto Rican, 5% white, all living in these projects. And they're just going bananas. Bambada spinning, you know, everything from like James Brown to the Monkees, Mary Mary, and kids are dancing all kinds of ways. Like black kids knowing that Bambada is spinning records that shouldn't be played and shouldn't work, but they do anyway. That's why Bambada was the king of records. That's why he could get away with playing like the TV theme song to I Dream of Jeannie. You know, like dun 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 dun, dun. And the kids would jump around like dancing is, and I knew what they were doing. I mean, this is my observational, you know, armchair anthropological instincts. The kids were dancing like, oh, this is how the punk rockers dance. So they'd jump around like doing the pogo and whatever whenever he would play something that wasn't clearly black-infused music, right? And I'm watching and observing this like, wow. Now, Malcolm doesn't see anything. All he sees is chaos. And he's like, Michael, we got to get out of here. We got to get out of here. And by the way, he's dressed like a pirate on acid. He's dressed like, you know, Culture Club and Adam Ant and this whole movement that was like New Romantics. And I'm just like, as I picked him up at the hotel to go up there, I'm like, oh, no, we're going to get vicked. Oh, no. I can't take him up to the Bronx. Like, but I knew if I said to him, you're going to have to change, man. We can't go to the Bronx with you dressed like this. He would have said, as any proud Englishman would do, oh, don't worry about me. We've colonized half the world. I can handle myself. But by the time when we got up there, he was shaking in his boots. He was like, get me out of here, man. We're not going to survive. I said, no. We got to get behind the ropes with Bambada.
The Raj is one thing.
So we got behind the ropes with Bambada. And, you know, I said, Bam, Bam, man, get Jazzy on the turntables. We're losing this guy. We're losing him, you know. So Jazzy gets on the turntable, starts doing a lot of turntablism. And I said, see Malcolm, see what that kid's doing, man. That see what Jazzy's doing, man. That's like special mix turntablism. And if you see that kid over there, he's breakdancing. Instead over there, that's graffiti. I said, this is the thing I wanted to show you. And he was like, okay, I get it. He said, let's get out of here, but I have an idea. So on the way downtown, he like said, I have a plan. When Bow Wow Wow comes to perform in September of 81, which is why he was there to promote Bow Wow Wow. He said, I want you to put together a review of this world to open up for them. And I was like, yes. And he gave me like, true to his word, he gave me like $3,000 or something. It was enough. And, you know, it was enough to pay everybody. I had Bambada on the turntables. This is at the Ritz or Webster Hall now.
Yeah.
Open it for Bow Wow Wow. I had Bambada on the turntables, Jazzy J on the turntables, Ike C on the mic, Zulu Nation MC, Brim doing graffiti, Rocksteady Crew dancing, and my film, Catch a Beat, playing on that big screen. And it was the first time that all the elements of hip-hop was presented in front of a paying audience. So I made history that night, September 15th, 1981. Sure, there was hip-hop up in clubs at the Fever and Stardust Ballroom years before this. but not all the elements, not writing, not dancing, not b-boying, not graph. And that was one of my proud moments in hip hop, one of those seminal moments when it was all put together on stage.
That's truly a pioneer moment. We're going to have you back, man, because we're only in 1981.
Only 1981.
And we haven't,
I'm telling you this,
and we haven't covered anything, but we're on time.
Time, and it was all fascinating.
Oh, this is over?
We're dude, finished. Yeah, yeah, because we go about 30 minutes or so.
Like 30 minutes.
Well, dude, it's a pleasure to have you here. And that was on
point.
Are we
still in the air?
I think we are. I got to at least do the rap.
Yeah, I
got to at least do a rap.
Got it.
It was great having you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And that was a great On Point with Michael Holman, hip-hop pioneer and historian. A new anthology series is launching on Two Dope Boys and a Podcast.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
This is Michael Holman coming to you from Two Dope Boys in Brooklyn. Do or die. Not necessarily Bed-Stuy, but it's Brooklyn. This is how we get down. So listen to Two Dope Boys because they're the shizzle.